This is the World Vision Report. I'm Melinda Pencava. While protests roll across the Arab world, Egypt tries to rebuild. We check in to see how they're doing. Meanwhile, next door in Israel, one out of every three Holocaust survivors is living below the poverty line.
I remembered looking at some of the pictures during the Holocaust of where these people were sleeping and what they were sleeping on, and the bed that she was sleeping on reminded me of that.
And in West Virginia, wives and daughters of coal miners form lasting bonds, line dancing.
Most of all, like to dance. Dance, dance, dance. Right foot stomp, left foot
stomp, you cha-cha with your right. The women have faced black lung, accidents, poverty, pollution, but...
Now, I could sit here and bellyache, but it doesn't accomplish anything, so why do that? Turn the music on, dance a little.
Around the world with the World Vision Report. First, this news. This is the World Vision Report. I'm Melinda Pencava, in for Peggy Waymire. While other parts of the Arab world are in turmoil now, Egypt celebrates a new beginning. But many Egyptians remain out of work, especially in the tourist industry. Wael Ghonim is the young Google executive who was imprisoned in Egypt for helping create the Facebook page that brought thousands together in Tahrir Square. This week, he sent out a Twitter message, tweeting, "Dear world, if you want to help Egyptians, come to Sharm el-Sheikh or Hurghada and enjoy a few days there. It's 100% safe." Tourism is Egypt's largest source of income, but 1 million tourists left the country during the recent revolution, and that's devastating the economy. Asia Bundawi traveled to Giza, one of Egypt's most famous spots, to see how people are doing.
It's late afternoon in Giza, and the massive pyramids here are practically gleaming in the sunlight. It's a familiar sight for Khamis Ali. For 22 years, he's been guiding tourists on horseback around the Giza pyramids, and he's just one of thousands of Egyptians who earn their living in the country's $13 billion tourism industry. But today, Khamis is witnessing an unfamiliar sight. Amidst the arid expanse of sand dunes and pyramids, there is not a single tourist to be found.
This area that we're riding through here is usually full of people, maybe 500 people in this area, and over there another 500 people. There were tourists and there were those who sold pharaoh costumes to foreigners and those who sold mini pyramids. Now these people can't find a way to feed themselves or to work. This is the first time in my life that I've ever seen anything like this.
More than 14 million people visit Egypt each year. But tourists fled in droves after the pro-democracy protests in Cairo began in late January. The Egyptians who make their living on the tourism trade in Giza have seen the collapse of the old regime and simultaneously the collapse of their livelihood. Khamis, a husband and father of three, keeps his horses at the stable near the pyramids. Outside the barn, other out-of-work guides mill about, cigarettes in hand. Their horses are tied to a nearby fence. Some are clearly emaciated, with protruding ribs and thinning flanks. No tourists to lug around means no food for the horses and no income for their drivers. For Khamis, life these past few tumultuous weeks has been a struggle.
Here we live day by day. For example, if God blesses you on one day with 50 or 60 Egyptian pounds, you'd use it for expenses on the same day. So if on a day there's no work, then there's no money and there's no food. When we used to be able to spend 10 Egyptian pounds, now we can only spend 1 or 2 Egyptian pounds. I mean, you eat one meal and you have to skip the second meal and you just try to bear it.
Yet while the economic situation for people here is dire, these days, the people of Giza, along with fellow Egyptians across the country, have taken to greeting each other by saying Mabruk, or congratulations. It's their way of celebrating the ousting of President Mubarak and the end of his 30-year rule over the country. Down the road from the stables, Ahmed Saeed runs a small convenience shop. It's stocked with water, snacks, cleaning products, and other goods. A couple of children wander in to buy candy. An older man stops by for a loose cigarette. Otherwise, it's a slow day for Ahmed. Normally, he says tourists make up for about half his daily sales. Now, he's only serving local Egyptian customers.
Of course, there's been no tourism, and the majority of stores and bazaars closed up, and even until now, no one's opened up shop. And the majority of people who work in tourism are just sitting at home. But of course we are happy. All of the Egyptian people are happy because of the downfall of the regime and the victory of the revolution. It's a huge accomplishment.
Back at the stables, Khamis stands around waiting for work. Though life these days is tough, Khamis is also optimistic.
It's a beautiful thing that happened, specifically because we took back our rights. Egypt was being bought and sold by the rich, and we were lost in the middle. There were people living with $2 or $3 million, and then there are people in Egypt who can't even find a place to sleep or a way to eat or drink. All of Egyptians today will tell you things are going to change and will be more beautiful than ever before because everyone will have their rights.
The question now is how long it will take for that change to come and for the tourists to come back. And without jobs, it's unclear how long people here will remain positive about the future. For the World Vision Report, I'm Asya Bendawi in Giza, Egypt.
Egypt's neighbor Israel is also facing protests about the rising price of bread, water, and gas. The labor movement is planning strikes and protests in coming weeks. In response, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu announced a series of measures to bring down the rising cost of food and fuel. As many as 1 in 4 Israelis lives in poverty. That includes many elderly Holocaust survivors. Daniel Estrin sent us a story about one of them.
Every survivor of the Holocaust has a story to tell. Some tell it in the comfort of their own home, surrounded by children and grandchildren, retired from a successful career. Not every Holocaust survivor's story ends this way.
I am ready to tell you what you want to hear, but I am not sure that it's just the story that you want to hear.
I definitely want to hear your story.
So I am old enough to remember a lot of things.
Her name is Ronnie. She has short, wispy gray hair and tilts to the side when she walks because of a swollen leg. For the last 30 years, Ronnie has lived alone in this dark one-room apartment without heat. During the frigid winters, she has to bundle up when she goes to the bathroom and kitchen, which are both in the yard. I'm using only Ronnie's first name to respect her privacy. Ronnie was only 14 years old when the Nazis occupied her native Hungary and put Jews in a ghetto. But Ronnie fled across the border to Romania, where she stayed safely with relatives for the rest of the war.
Tell me what happened to your family, your parents.
Ronnie's expression suddenly changes. She closes her eyes, turns her head, and shudders. A safe house was arranged for her mother, but when she arrived, she headed back out on the street to gather a few belongings.
It was shot on the street. And my father was not a young man anymore. He was taken on the dead march and was killed on the way, died on the way.
Ronnie was an only child and the only surviving member of her family. So after the war, she made it to Israel, where she served in the army, studied in university, and worked many jobs. She never married. Today, at 81, Ronnie lives off of her pension and social security. Both are meager.
It is never enough, but you have to live according to what you have.
Ronnie still struggles to make ends meet every single month, and when she doesn't have enough money for food, she simply doesn't eat.
That's Darla Oz, a retiree from Ohio who moved to Israel with her husband 10 years ago. They founded House to House, a small charity that helps the poor. That includes about 50 Holocaust survivors. Throughout the week, Darla makes a round of visits. I joined her one Friday.
My whole trunk is full of food, and I have to deliver food to two people. One is a Holocaust survivor. The Holocaust survivor lives in the most horrific, I can't even find words for it, horrific situation. And he's the one that I recently found that only had 3 pieces of bread in his house.
There are about 250,000 Holocaust survivors living in Israel today. 1 out of every 3 of them live below the poverty line. Many Holocaust survivors have unusually high medical expenses related to the poor living conditions they experienced during the war. And since many survivors lost all family in the Holocaust, they have few or no relatives alive to support them in their old age. Those are some reasons why the poverty rate for Holocaust survivors in Israel is higher than the general poverty rate for Israel's elderly. It's simply poetic injustice, Darla says. When Darla first visited Ronnie in her apartment, she took one look at her bed and was reminded of concentration camp barracks.
She was sleeping on a platform bed that just did not have a mattress. It just was wood and then just had a very thin pad. And I remembered looking at some of the pictures during the Holocaust of where these people were sleeping and what they were sleeping on. And the bed that she was sleeping on reminded me of that.
Many survivors do receive monthly checks from the German government as reparations for the horrors they experienced. The Israeli government also gives survivors money. But there are plenty of impoverished survivors who don't receive a penny. The application process is complicated and criteria are strict. Not everyone qualifies. Aviva Silberman directs Spring for Holocaust Survivors, a nonprofit that helps survivors apply for those funds. She's a monthly guest on a call-in show on Israeli radio. Dozens of Holocaust survivors and their family call in each month for advice on how to get financial assistance. But sometimes Silberman has to bear unpleasant news. She tells this caller that his relative, who survived the ghetto in Budapest, doesn't qualify for German reparations. The Budapest ghetto only lasted a few months, and the fund only assists survivors who were in a ghetto for at least a year and a half. That rule has also prevented Ronnie from qualifying for reparations. Silberman says the Israeli government recently began giving money to many more survivors from Budapest to fill the gap. Darla Oz, who's helping Ronnie, says she'll look into it for her.
I brought your paper. Where would you like me to put it?
Put it here just now.
Okay. Oz brings Ronnie the newspaper every Friday. She also brings her food and books. She loves detective novels. Last winter, she brought her two blankets. Darla later found out that Ronnie gave one of the blankets to her elderly neighbor who was sick.
Dignity comes in many forms. Dignity comes in having your needs met, and it also comes in being able to meet the need of someone else. So for her, the decision to make a sacrifice to give a blanket provided her with a dignity.
In Israel, about 30 Holocaust survivors die every day. For Oz, it's important to help them live out their last years with honor. She says that since she started caring for Ronnie, the elderly woman seems more at peace. And now, Ronnie has someone new in her life.
Simba. Simba. She's an interesting dog. She was used for dog fighting and was rescued by somebody.
Ronnie saved herself from the hands of the Nazis when she fled at age 14. Now, in this late chapter of her life, she's helped save another life.
We are happy together.
For the World Vision Report, I'm Daniel Estrin in Jerusalem.
More ahead on the World Vision Report. I'm Melinda Pencava, and this is the World Vision Report. The riots in Egypt and in Tunisia were sparked in part by the rising cost of food. It's estimated that 1 billion people go to bed hungry each night. The British government put together a team of experts to figure out the best way to address that. The answer is published in a study called Foresight, The Future of Food and Farming. Professor Charles Godfrey is chair of the group. He says there's a perfect storm ahead. Climate change will lead to more extreme weather events that can harm farming. The world's population is growing, and as people get richer, their diets change. They start eating more meat.
If the global world population was to eat meat at the rate we do, then it would be completely unsustainable. And so as populations get richer and they demand the diet that we enjoy in the richer world, there is a risk of real threats to the food system. And so the report has been exploring what might be done to address that now.
What are some of the things you're suggesting there?
Well, if I could take a sort of overview first, one of the things that we do suggest, or do argue very strongly, is that food needs to really rise up the political agenda. We've enjoyed possibly historically low levels of food prices over the last 40 years, and I think that means that food has sort of dropped out of the headlines in a way that would be astonishing to our parents' generation. And we look at the food system, both supply, demand, and the efficiency of the food system, and argue very strongly that action needs to be taken at all, in all three levels. So we need to produce more food, and we need to do that by spreading best practice at the moment. We need to invest in research so that we can address the challenges ahead. And we need to look at the efficiency of the food system. It's a difficult statistic to button down, but most estimates suggest that 30% of food that is produced is actually wasted, and wasted in different ways in rich and poorer countries. And finally, we have to have a dialogue about the food we eat. Should we all be eating some of the most resource-demanding food that, for example, certain forms of meat that we do at the moment? And the report stresses that all these decisions need to be made in the light of two things. How do they affect the world's poorest people? And how do they affect the sustainability of the food system? Because one thing that is absolutely clear at the moment is the way we produce food at the moment is not sustainable. It's destroying the capital upon which future food is based.
Professor Charles Godfrey chaired the lead expert group for the UK government study called Foresight, the Future of Food and Agriculture. Thanks for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
When it comes to feeding the planet, sometimes small-scale solutions can make a big difference. So says a new report from the organization World Watch. It's called State of the World 2011, Innovations That Nourish the Planet. The World Watch team spent over a year visiting 250 projects in sub-Saharan Africa. They saw what's working now and what could be done in the future. Danielle Nierenberg is the World Watch project director.
One of the big things that we found on the ground is that there are a lot of innovations around feeding people in cities. 14 million people are moving to African cities annually, and this is a migration that's really second only to the massive migration taking place in China. And so finding ways to feed people in these very crowded and polluted African cities is more important than ever before. I had the opportunity to visit Kibera, which is the largest slum in sub-Saharan Africa. It's located in Nairobi, and we talked to two groups of different farmers there. One is a group of women who've organized themselves into what they call a self-help group. And the self-help group is doing some interesting farming in what they call vertical gardens. And essentially, these vertical gardens are tall sacks filled with soil that they poke holes in to grow a lot of food in a very small place. And so they're growing really nutritious leafy greens like kale and spinach. And they're selling part of what they grow so that they're earning an income. And when riots, similar to the riots that are taking place in Egypt and Tunisia and elsewhere, took place in Nairobi in 2008, no food could really be transported into Nairobi. But the families of the women in these self-help groups didn't go hungry because they had their vertical gardens.
One thing I thought was interesting in this report was the issue of food waste. What were some of the projects that target that problem?
Food waste is a huge problem. About 40% of the global harvest is wasted before it ever reaches market. And this comes about from pests, destroying crops, mold, fungus, from improper storage and other problems. And what we saw on the ground is that in places like Niger, for example, where cowpeas are the staple food, they're very protein-rich beans that nearly everyone eats on a daily basis. But farmers were losing about half of their harvest because they couldn't keep the cowpeas from becoming moldy or from getting attacked by pests. And Purdue University is working on a triple-layered, hermetically sealed plastic bag that is very inexpensive. It costs about $2 for about 10 of these bags. And the cowpeas, instead of going to waste, can last for 6 months to a year. You know, this might not sound like that innovative to those of us who use Ziploc bags every day, but it's a real innovation for these farmers who were losing, on average, about $225 million annually.
Well, Danielle, can you give me an overview of the kinds of solutions that were included in your report?
We talked about everything from improving the role of women farmers. Women make up 80% of the agricultural labor force in sub-Saharan Africa, but they typically lack access to credit. They typically aren't able to own land. They typically lack access to extension services, so they have trouble learning about different agricultural innovations because extension agents talk to men and not to women. So we, as you mentioned, talk about innovations in waste management and preventing food from being wasted. And a more simple solution than the hermetically sealed bags I spoke about are simply solar dryers. In places like the Gambia, where there's a season for mangoes and other nutritious fruits, making sure that women farmers have the access to solar dryers or dehydrators so that they can make sure that those fruits are available throughout the year, because they can provide important vitamin A nutrients to kids, and the women can also sell them to make a profit. We also talked about innovations in policy and making sure, again, that the agricultural funding community is aware of the multiplicity of efforts going on around the world, and that there's a lot of opportunity to make sure that these innovations get scaled up and replicated.
What needs to happen for those successes to be replicated?
The barriers really come from the international funding and donor communities and national governments, who are reluctant to sort of invest, I think, in these very, you know, simple solutions. They're looking for more silver bullet type solutions. And
why do you think that's the case?
Those things are a little bit more sexy. If you're talking about a really interesting technology that a research institute has developed, I think it sounds a lot better to investors. They're looking for the easy fix in a lot of ways. And I think that's what makes those options more attractive. But the real sustainable solutions will come from investing in people.
Danielle Nierenberg is the World Watch Project Director for State of the World 2011, Innovations That Nourish the Planet. Thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you.
You can find links to the World Watch study on our website at worldvisionreport.org. As we heard, Danielle Nierenberg talked about how proper storage could reduce the amount of food being wasted. With me now is the World Vision Report's Cynthia Graber. She came across one potential solution for storing food. Cynthia, you found it close to your home in Massachusetts, didn't you?
Yeah, that's true. I live near Harvard and MIT, and also near a center for local tech startups. So it's a great place to learn about technology.
So what did you find?
It's actually a technology to help India's farmers. But first, let's meet the two guys who developed it.
My name is Soreen Grama, one of the co-founders of Promethean Power Systems.
And I'm Sam White. I'm the other co-founder of Promethean Power.
So Sam and I met during the business plan competition at MIT. This was in 2006.
These guys, they came up with a solar-powered generator to provide electricity, and they won second prize and $10,000. So Sam and Soreen went off to India.
We wrote the business plan basically without even stepping on the ground in India.
Did you catch that?
Without even stepping on the ground in India.
No, we thought this was going to be a technology for kiosks to be able to, you know, light their stores instead of using kerosene. We had no idea what we were doing.
And folks on the ground in India seemed to agree. Their new technology was like a solution in search of a problem. But they didn't have to look very far to find that problem, a glass of milk.
Well, I don't know if anybody knows this, but India is the largest producer of milk in the world.
Indian dairy owner Kishore Mosale says even though his country produces more milk than anywhere else on the planet, India also has a milk shortage, and here's why.
You know, milk is being raised not on organized dairy farms. Milk is being raised by lots of farmers having one cow, maybe two cows, a buffalo or so, and they're spread out all over the place. But collecting this milk effectively is the biggest challenge.
Okay, imagine what your life would be like if you were an Indian dairy farmer. Wait, scratch that. Imagine you're an American dairy farmer. You might have hundreds of cows and gleaming machines to help you milk them. That milk is instantly chilled. Now, picture being a dairy farmer in Tiptur, India. You live on a small subsistence farm out in the countryside. The roads are unpaved, and you get only a few hours of electricity each day.
Right now, it's a race against time. They need to get that milk chilled within 4 hours of the cows and buffaloes being milked.
Indian farmers schlep their milk to village collection centers. The dairies drive around twice a day to collect it. Along the way, as much as a third of the milk spoils. And that's how Sam and Soreen found their calling. After meeting with a dairy business in India, they learned that if the villagers could chill their milk locally, dairy drivers would only have to make the trek to fetch the milk maybe once every other day. And some Indian farmers could earn up to 3 times as much money as they do now. Sure, there are diesel-powered chillers in India, but they're expensive to use and maintain. So here's where Promethean power kicks in. When the sun shines, which it often does in India, the milk chiller is powered by solar panels. Otherwise, it runs off the few available hours of electricity.
So the sound you're hearing is the compressor itself, the pumps, the fan, everything. It, almost like your home refrigerator.
But instead of cooling food, it chills a special liquid.
It's actually a mixture of water and some other chemicals, which we can't talk about.
Because that's proprietary.
Yes. So that cold liquid is sort of the key to it, and you know, it runs through everything. And then
it's your magical liquid.
The magic liquid, yes.
That liquid is designed to stay cold until farmers have the chance to deliver their milk. They pour it through a funnel, and 4 seconds later, it's chilled by that magical liquid that's running through nearby pipes. Then the cold milk is stored in a silver tank. Promethean Power developed one prototype last year. The farmers liked it, but gave them some feedback to make it better. So now their second prototype is done, and they're heading back to India to test it out. Meanwhile, the owner of the original Indian dairy they met with placed an order for a few of the machines.
He turns to me and said, "So what do you and Serene do for a living?" And I said, "Mr. Chandramohan, 100% of our day is spent thinking about chilling milk in India, in your country." And I think it was a pity purchase order, what they call it.
Right now, the chillers cost nearly $12,000 a pop. These entrepreneurs are years away from turning a profit, but that's their goal.
Serene and I did not start this to do good in the world. We started it because we thought it's an untapped market. It doesn't mean that we're not grateful that that's a serious side effect, the social impact. But by no means do we consider ourselves do-gooders.
Still, chilling the milk in India could do a lot of good for farmers, for dairies, for the health of Indians, and perhaps even for the Indian economy. For the World Vision Report, I'm Cynthia Graber.
There are no simple solutions to the AIDS crisis in Africa, but for several years, researchers have known there is one thing that greatly reduces the risk of being infected with HIV/AIDS, male circumcision. In South Africa, a country devastated by the epidemic, there is one clinic where men can be circumcised for free. Tarai Maduna reports.
It's just after 8 a.m. on a windy morning in Orange Farm, a township about 25 miles outside Johannesburg. A group of young men are already waiting at the gate of the Wopelopele male circumcision clinic. When the clinic opens, the young men are ushered into a counseling room. There are about 11 men in this group. Some are friends and joke around before they begin a counseling session on the benefits of being circumcised.
Everything is so discussed. It's private and confidential.
Sibongile Chia, a counselor at the clinic, tells the men about the benefits and the risks of the procedure. She also gives them information on HIV/AIDS and other sexually transmitted infections or STIs.
Well, yeah, we try our best to make sure that they understand.
That's Dr. Dirk Taliad, who manages the project.
We try our best to not just be a surgery where you can storm in, get cut, and disappear.
Dr. Taliad was one of the researchers in the groundbreaking male circumcision study that made headlines back in 2005. The study included patients from Orange Farm and showed that circumcision reduces the risk of HIV infection by 60%. So this clinic was opened in the hopes that widespread circumcision will reduce an area's overall HIV transmission rate. It's funded by two groups, the French National Agency for AIDS Research and the U.S. Agency for International Development. Dr. Taliad says the clinic counselors make sure that people do not think getting circumcised is a license to have unprotected sex.
We're trying really hard to make people understand exactly what we are doing. We're trying to make sure that they understand that this is partial protection, that there's still a risk and that you still need to be careful, that you still need to use condoms. And so we're trying to make people understand that it reduces your risk, it doesn't remove your risk.
I ask some of the men why they have come here. One agrees to speak to me on the condition that I do not reveal his name.
There's a guy on my street. Yeah, he told me on Sunday about it. Because I've been wanting to do this for a long time now. But to be honest, I'm trying to avoid all these STIs and all. And I've been postponing for years now. Every year I'd say I'll go next year. every year it's next year. So I felt it's time now to do it. It's either now or never.
To get men like this one to come into the clinic, there's a community outreach program. Think of it as a circumcision roadshow. At a nearby shopping center, a clinic worker stands in the trailer of a slowly moving truck. He speaks into a microphone and tells people about the free clinic. The clinic also uses the local radio station Teta FM to promote its work in the community. Even though the clinic offers free circumcision, some men still opt to go back to their rural villages and undergo circumcision there, where it's part of a traditional group initiation ceremony into manhood. But Dr. Taliad says his project found that some men who thought they had been circumcised in a traditional ceremony had actually not been.
So they will still say, I'm circumcised, but the foreskin has not been removed. Of course, if the foreskin is still in place, you haven't got the protection that we are talking about.
That means their risk for HIV infection was not reduced, but the clinic has found a way to address this. It has managed to partner with some local community elders so that young men come to the clinic for circumcision before they go to their rural communities for initiation rites.
We're saying to them, let's talk to each other, let's work together, let's see. It's not our job to monitor what they are doing. It's not our job to change what they are doing, and we're not trying to do that. But we're saying that we're giving an alternative.
So far, the prognosis is good. The Wopelopele Male Circumcision Clinic has conducted more than 20,000 circumcisions since it opened in 2008. The clinic's goal is to circumcise 80% of all adult and young males in the Orange Farm Township.
So this is a mammoth task. This is a huge task. And the quicker we do this, the more infections we can prevent. So there's really a great urgency for us to do this.
South Africa's Department of Health has been so impressed with the Wopelopele Male Circumcision Project. It's drafting plans to roll out its own circumcision centers across the country. For the World Vision Report, I'm Taurai Maduna in Orange Farm, South Africa.
In Haiti, it's not Facebook or Twitter that gives people a place to protest. It's the radio. That story ahead on the World Vision Report. This is the World Vision Report. I'm Melinda Pencava. Since Haiti's earthquake 13 months ago, Haitian journalists, particularly those on the radio, have found a new freedom to air the complaints of an increasingly vocal public. Radio stations are airing things that not so long ago could have gotten journalists killed. 40% of adults in Haiti cannot read, so radio is one way that people can connect with their government and hold it accountable. Jennifer Maloney tells the story of one Haitian radio reporter who has found a new voice since the earthquake.
Mackinson Ramey sits in a tent on a Port-au-Prince street, speaking into a microphone. 3 months have passed since the earthquake. He talks about gas shortages, rubble-filled streets, the dangers for women in Haiti's sprawling tent camps. Rain patters on the vinyl roof and runs over the cables at his feet. Night after night, Mackinson's broadcasts come down to a single question.
Where is the change?
Where is the change?
Many money for Haiti. I see many newspapers on Haiti, but where is the change? This is my problem.
It's a question echoing in his listeners' minds. Mackinson is a reporter and host for Radio Caraïbe, one of the top stations in a city of 2.5 million people.
After the earthquake, before the earthquake, the same problem. The same Haiti. With big problem, no electricity, no good water. Food are very expensive.
Mackinson is 34 years old. His fans call him Cat Paquette. In Creole, that means 4x4. That's because, like the GP drives, Mackinson has a reputation for going anywhere to get a story, even into the dangerous slums that other journalists avoid. Mackinson isn't afraid of the slums because he grew up in one. He's part of a small corps of Haitian journalists covering the stalled reconstruction efforts for listeners in Haiti and abroad. In November, he reported live from a tent camp to Radio Panou in New York on an election marred by fraud.
This morning we woke up to many burning tires. There are also small handguns being fired timidly in some neighborhoods.
Mackinson's late-night show is a mix of news, commentary, and satire. It airs twice a week. Last month, he also started hosting a daily morning news program called How is Port-au-Prince?
I can give a joke on the president. I can give a joke on the minister.
Jokes about Haiti's politicians, among other things, are what get him into trouble with government officials.
Sometimes they call me and they say they hate that. And sometimes I change my voice. Yes, I talk like the president, just a way to tease them, just a way to ask them to change the country. Sometimes I talk as Aristide too.
Jean-Bertrand Aristide, Haiti's first democratically elected president, was deposed and exiled with the help of the U.S. And Mackinson, on his late-night program, mimics Aristide's radio addresses from exile in South Africa.
Femme, sem, zamim, famim, mon ki te vote myo.
Mackinson's jokes underline a serious point.
It's not only me joker. I think all the president hate is joker. A government after government, you meet the same problems. Coup d'etat after coup d'etat, you find the same problem.
Not long ago, satire like that in Haiti could get you killed. At least 7 Haitian journalists have been murdered in the past 10 years. Mackinson himself was nearly killed in 2005. He was hosting a call-in show on Radio Megastar. Some of his segments bothered the elites who had overthrown President Aristide, so they tried to buy Mackinson's silence.
They asked me to collaborate with them, to be cool, and to give up the news. I said, no.
A few weeks later, 2 police vehicles followed Mackinson home.
And they tried to stop my car on the road. They called me, hey, Mackinson, and you speak for Jean-Bertrand Aristide.
6 men dragged him from his car. 10 others stood guard.
It was with gun, with long gun, they beat me. They say, you give breaking news and we're going to break you.
Mackinson believed he was going to die. Then people began to gather. They saw the press badge on the dashboard of his Jeep, and they called out his nickname, Cat Pa Cat, 4x4.
They say, hey, this is Mackinson Cat Pa Cat. He's a popular journalist. I used to listen to him on the radio, blah, 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 so you can't kill him.
The attackers drove off, leaving Mackinson with a bleeding face and a bruised body. His journalism almost got him killed, but it also saved his life.
It's why now I am alive.
The attack was covered by the Associated Press. Radio Megastar shut down for 3 months. Mackinson's family begged him to give up journalism.
My family, my father said it was too dangerous. My little sister said the same thing. And some of my friends said me the same thing too.
Eventually, he did give up radio news. He started hosting a show on music.
Yes, it's better when you talk about music. There is no problem. And nobody can target you because music is cool.
January 12, 2010. An earthquake kills 250,000 people in Haiti. The airwaves go silent. As the surviving journalists return to the air, stations shift from music and entertainment to news and analysis.
C'est un cas de sécurité n'a pas l'ouvri à 4e page journal là.
Mackinson, broadcasting from a tent, turns his focus from music to the chaos around him.
Dans toute pompe gasoline, yo nèg s'est fait la queue.
Oui, c'est
vrai. Il est bon qu'il levé à 5h du matin pour y aller chercher gaz là.
Haiti's radio stations are struggling to stay on the air. They're propped up by public service announcements from the government. Mackinson earns $10 a day. Mackinson, who was born in a slum and climbed his way up to middle-class life, slipped backward after the quake. His apartment was condemned. He slept in his car. And in April, after the birth of his first child, he moved his family into the tiny cinder block home of his girlfriend's mother.
Hey.
She lives on a canal filled with garbage in Saint-Martin, the same slum where Mackinson grew up. In December, Mackinson was attacked again, this time by a crowd protesting the first round results of Haiti's presidential election. Calling him a government operative, they punched him, stole his phone, and smashed his car windows. The next day, he went back to work.
Reporting in the street is my life. Working for poor people. Working for people desperate, for people who doesn't have hope.
In the years since the earthquake, Mackinson's station has been rebuilt, and he finally saved up enough to move his family to a safer neighborhood. Haitian media observers don't know how long this moment of press freedom will last. Mackinson says he'll keep reporting. He likes to sing as he drives in Port-au-Prince traffic. His Suzuki tracker keeps breaking down while he's out reporting. A leak in the exhaust system fills the Jeep with fumes. A press pass hangs from his rearview mirror. For the World Vision Report, I'm Jennifer Maloney.
Haiti is full of foreigners who are there to help the country deal with the aftermath of the earthquake. Many of them were there before the disaster. In fact, Haiti has more aid organizations per capita than anywhere else in the world. But the earthquake brought another kind of visitor, what journalist Rory Carroll calls aid tourists. Carroll wrote a story for the London-based Guardian newspaper in which he describes flying to Haiti and what he saw around him on the plane.
A lot of goodwill, a lot of desire to help, and a lot of excitement from the several hundred people that were packed onto that plane. But that line was somewhat ironic because really I felt that, unfortunately, tragically, that those efforts are mostly going to go to waste. And in fact, that plane load of goodwill is in many ways more part of the problem than of the solution to Haiti's problems.
Give us some examples of that.
Well, the guy I was seated next to was a very charming and pleasant and energetic Canadian former retired dairy farmer who was part of a group that had, on their own dime, was flying down to Haiti to build some schools and build some houses, which sounds great. And, I mean, the guy is a very likable guy, but when he explained the details to me, it really raised a lot of questions in my mind. And the fact that they were spending $4,000 per house, the fact that there was no real supervision, and the fact that they were entirely dependent on a local young Haitian fixer to coordinate everything, and the fact that on their own admission, that every time they left Haiti after just a visit of a couple of weeks, work would stop. And the significance of this is that I think this is a story that's replicated across Haiti.
You know, a person hearing this would say, well, what does Haiti need? Because there you have this well-meaning Canadian group that went there, and as a result, there was a home that was built. So that's one more person in Haiti that has a structure that's not a tent and not temporary housing.
Well, what Haiti needs is Haiti run by Haitians, which means a good, strong government that has good, strong, sensible policies. With people on the ground who are Haitians making these decisions, which means not having thousands and thousands of Westerners flying in and basically making the decisions on behalf of Haitians.
Carroll says he's seen these so-called aid tourists all over Haiti.
These extraordinary scenes, you know, you drive around Port-au-Prince, which still looks, a year after the earthquake, it still resembles an apocalyptic zone with rubble everywhere. And there are 4x4s with these blonde kids from California, from Hawaii, with their iPods on and the headphones in, and you can see them just driving around, soaking up the sights as tourists. And, you know, it turns Haiti into a zoo when you see people like that, because they're not bad people. I mean, they're not there to do malice, but what they are doing is they're soaking up resources.
Those are resources, Carroll says, that could be better spent paying Haitians to do the jobs themselves. But what about those medical professionals who've been asked to come to Haiti to provide care? I asked Rory Carroll about them.
I wouldn't quarrel with it because it's fine and it's great to have someone coming in and sharing their skills. And certainly Haitians would benefit from that, and that has to be applauded. I think that's terrific. But it has to be done within a proper system. What is happening in some cases, not all, but in some cases, is foreign doctors will come in and it would be quite expensive to bring them in. Again, you're thinking of flights and then you've got to be put up, you know, the whole infrastructure just to support them. And they might only be there for a few weeks. They'll need always translation services because they won't otherwise really be able to operate or function properly without translation services. And you need a whole kind of panoply of support. But meantime, what you're also having is a lot of Haitian doctors and nurses are unemployed because they don't have jobs and because they've sort of been crowded out of the market almost by Western doctors, left literally sitting on rubble, if they're lucky, with a tarpaulin over their heads, and they're watching these 4x4s with Western medical experts whizzing by. Now, there's something wrong with that picture. It's a very complicated, nuanced picture, and there's a lot of unintended effect. People trying to do good inadvertently sometimes, in the doing of good, they're creating other problems that they may not be aware of.
That was Rory Carroll, a reporter with the Guardian newspaper. Americans around the country are struggling in this recession, but in southern West Virginia, coal mining communities have been living with economic downturns for decades. There was a big bust in the 50s and 60s. 20 years later, the coal mines closed again. Discouraged by the dangers of mining and the lack of other jobs, many working-aged people have moved away. But what of the older residents who've remained? Sierra Crane Murdoch reports from one town and one dance floor near the Coal River.
Oh, Miss, you gotta push it.
It's a Thursday night in Whitesville, West Virginia. The only place open on the main drag is a dance hall. Inside, women with perms and tennis shoes push tables to the side of the room. A few stop to chat beneath a giant Elvis poster. Others tap out steps to a new dance routine. They shuffle, stomp, and spin in unison.
Most of all, I like to dance. Dance, dance, dance. In fact, the license plate on the front of my car says Swingin' Grandma.
That's Carrie Lou Jarrell. Line dancing was her idea 15 years ago. Her husband worked long hours at the mines. Her daughter had moved away.
And here I sit, by myself, nothing to do.
That's when she made a phone call to her friend Lori, a dance teacher.
So I called her and invited her to come down and teach a few of us how to line dance. Well, yeah, if you have any turnout, I said, okay. Well, we had a fantastic turnout.
Rock, shuffle, rock, shuffle. Turn, turn.
For these women, the dance hall is a bright spot in a hard-hit place.
Oh, gosh, Whitesville's nothing. Buildings have been torn down.
Clothing store, grocery stores, furniture stores, any kind of store you would want was in Whitesville. Now there is nothing.
And there's just not any other source of income here other than that coal mines.
Coal, coal, coal.
Times are tough, but the women still show up to dance. They practice twice a week. Then, on weekends, they go show off at a bigger dance hall an hour north.
Somebody else take over. Somebody else count.
And that's one time that everybody left the floor just to watch us. And it makes you feel good. Makes you feel really good that somebody thinks you can do something right.
And it's nights like these that tighten the bond between them.
Yeah. Well, they gave me a birthday cake the other day, and she, Pauline, put this big 84 on it. You know, well, that don't look too swift. So I run up there, and I changed the 4 in front of the 8, so I'm 48. Looked a lot better.
And we put it back and said, Packy, be proud of that 84. You're up here kicking up your heels.
I don't consider myself the oldest. I just go in there and line dance.
That's Elizabeth Casto.
But everybody calls me Punky.
Line dancing is one way Punky puts aside her troubles. And she admits she's had a lot of them.
I am a coal miner's daughter and a coal miner's wife. Twice. Both of my husbands died with black lung. So when all these accidents and things happen, nobody can tell me about a coal miner.
She's talking about the mine explosion at Upper Big Branch last spring. It happened only a few miles south of here. Punky blames the accident on Massey Energy, the mine owner. And it's not all she blames them for. Massey has been mining the mountains around Whitesville since the early 80s. They built a stoker plant for crushing coal just outside of town.
It is a nasty town to live in. We are completely covered with coal dust the biggest part of the time.
It was a couple of line dancers who brought Massey to court. The women won, and the company had to install a huge plastic bubble around the stoker plant. It helped, some, and as Carrie Lou explains, it brought the women that much closer.
But you know, the number one thing about these girls, and I want to tell you, is when you need them, they're there. When Virgil got sick and was in the hospital, I got stuck down there and didn't have a penny to my name. Listen, there come her with an envelope with money in it for me, and they even bought minutes for my telephone so I could talk to people. Yeah. Life is just what you make out of it. Now, I could sit here and bellyache, but it doesn't accomplish anything. So why do that? Turn your music on, dance a little.
These women lighten the lives of others in the community as well.
Lord, we've done Dolly Parton, we've done
Reba.
She even did Johnny Cash once.
Oh, we have skits and we have parades, and I play Betty Boop, and I got me a red slick slimy dress. And I get out and I sing, I'm not one of a greedy kind. All of my wants are wishes. I know what's on my mind. I'm just
we could at least offer some fun and some companionship and friendship, you know what I'm saying?
Now listen.
And we are all good friends. And it just, I just wonder what those women do that don't do anything but cook and wash dishes and do clothes.
I want to be kissed by you. Boopy doopy doop boop boop boop. That's my Betty Boop.
I have enjoyed my life. Biggest part of that, I've had ups and downs and but that goes with life, and that's the way it is.
For the World Vision Report, I'm Sierra Crane Murdoch in Whitesville, West Virginia.
That's it. We had a ball with it.
Angela Evansy co-produced that story. And for this week, that's the World Vision Report. I'm Melinda Pencava.
Support for this program comes from World Vision, building a better world for children. The views expressed on this show are not necessarily those of the organization.